A bill revising Pennsylvania's charter school law is being hotly debated in the Capitol. I'm Dave Heller, and this is NewsWorks Tonight. As Keystone Crossroads' Kevin McCory reports, the bill would be the first significant update to the original charter law since it was passed nearly 20 years ago.
2 decades after its inception, there is wide agreement that the state's charter law has fallen well behind the times.
The charter law in Pennsylvania, relative to laws in other states, has consistently been dropping every year in terms of its effectiveness.
That was Robert Fayfitch, executive director of the Pennsylvania Coalition for Public Charter Schools. State Auditor General Eugene DePasquale recently took that sentiment a step further.
Our charter school law is simply the worst charter school law in the United States.
Lawmakers are currently negotiating the details of a new bill. One version is available to the public, but leaders continue to tweak language behind closed doors, potentially giving people very little time to read the changes before a vote. That makes Jim Buckhite of the Pennsylvania Association of School Administrators nervous.
The latest version that was public, we believe, is tilted too far on the charter school side.
So what's in the bill as written? There's a few things that pretty much everybody likes. Charter board members would have to adhere to a stricter set of ethical standards. A state commission would be set up to study charter school funding. And all charters would need to use a state-created common enrollment application, making the process simpler and more transparent for parents. But, of course, there's also plenty for people to disagree about.
There's a lot missing. There's internal contradictions. There's words that could be interpreted a variety of ways without definitions.
Donna Cooper is the executive director of Public Citizens for Children and Youth. She and other traditional public school advocates don't like the bill in large part because of things that aren't in there. As written, the existing charter law does not allow school districts to unilaterally limit charter school enrollment growth. Cooper says that's a must to ensure that districts can manage their finances.
It's a bill that's not ready for prime time, and it's being shoved through in the last days of the legislative session.
The School District of Philadelphia, which oversees by far the most charters in the state, also opposes the bill as written. It wants to see reforms that would force charters to meet quality standards, and it particularly wants the power to shut down poorly performing schools more quickly. Dawn Lynn Kaser is the head of the district's charter office.
And so when we have a law that does not allow for strong charter authorizing practices, there is a weakness there. There is a break in the link.
The bill also stacks the state charter appeals board with more charter-friendly nominees, and it sets up a separate performance evaluation system for charters. Those that score high would be able to be renewed for a 10-year term instead of the typical 5. Charter advocates laud these potential changes and, on the whole, feel the bill is fair to all sides. Jonathan Sattell is executive director of PennCAN, a pro-charter reform group that has been lobbying aggressively for the bill.
Compromises in politics often happens because both sides realize that the cost of doing nothing is the worst case scenario.
All of these debates are happening in the midst of an extremely fluid larger negotiation about how to pay for Pennsylvania's budget. Sources say Republican leaders are insisting on the passage of a charter bill as part of any final deal. A source close to Governor Wolf says he will not sign any bill that fails to allow districts like Philadelphia to hold charter growth in check. Kevin McCory, Keystone Crossroads.
Keystone Crossroads is a statewide public media initiative reporting on challenges facing Pennsylvania cities. WHYY is the lead station. Well, now, the Democratic National Convention is roughly 2 weeks out, and that means many are busy readying Philadelphia for the thousands of attendees expected to stream into the city. All that prep boils down to money and a lot of different budget items. WHYY's Aaron Mozell offers this look at some of the numbers behind the big event.
Let's start with something basic, attendance. Up to 50,000 people are expected to take part in the festivities throughout the week. But a good chunk of them, possibly more than half, will be media. And a lot of them will spend hours at the Wells Fargo Center in South Philly, where the politicians will be most of the time. That means the city won't be the sardine can it was when the Pope was in town last fall. Merrill Levitz is CEO of Visit Philadelphia. She says the city will be just as bikeable and walkable as it always is.
It's pretty much the same number of people who go to a football game. And there will be 18,000 volunteers who will be helping people get around.
Things in South Philly will be a bit busier, especially before delegates arrive. Crews will run nearly 1,000 miles of cable inside the Wells Fargo Center, fiber optic and otherwise. Just about as many signs will go up around the stadium complex. Nearly 3,000 seats will be removed for the main stage and podium. Travis Dredd is the deputy CEO for Convention Complex Management. He says end-to-end, it'll take nearly 2 months to get the Wells Fargo ready for its close-up.
We're working pretty much regular business hours, but they're pretty intense and dense. 9 to 10 hour days right now. You have close to about 475, almost 500 people daily throughout the Wells Fargo Center now helping to put it together.
All of it in the name of political theater, pageantry, which brings me to donkeys. Yes, donkeys. The Philadelphia Mural Arts Program will have 3 or 4 donkey doctors to make cosmetic fixes to the nearly 60 fiberglass donkeys put up around Center City to celebrate the DNC. Jane Golden heads up the Mural Arts Program.
They will truly be like a doctor who's making house calls. They will have their bag of paints and they will be ready and on the spot to make the repairs that are needed.
Merrill Levitz with Visit Philly estimates the economic impact of the convention to be between $250 and $300 million. The cost of the convention is approximately $60 million. The city is spending nearly $700,000 on non-security related items, including setup and cleanup, graffiti removal, and decorations. One number that can't be quantified right now, the long-range impact of having such a big international spotlight on Philadelphia. I'm Aaron Mozell, WHYY News.
Just about everyone in the world who knows how to read cuneiform tablets is in Philadelphia this week for a major economic conference on ancient Mesopotamia. From WHYY's Arts and Culture Desk, Peter Crimmins reports the original city of Ur is on the rise.
In the game of ancient civilizations, there is a line between Egyptologists and Assyriologists, or people who study what used to be Assyria, what's now Iraq. Egypt, with its pyramids full of gold, tends to be more popular. Grant Frame, an Assyriologist at the University of Pennsylvania, says the situation in modern Iraq makes it difficult to study ancient Mesopotamia.
Due to the problems several years ago in the looting of the Iraq Museum, there are problems with their records, restoring them, and of course some materials have suffered over time there as well.
Frame is the local coordinator of the Rencontre Assyriologique Internationale, a conference attracting about 300 people from over 30 countries. The last 3 decades have been rough on them, due to military and political upheaval in Iraq. Only recently has archaeological work been able to resume there. The University of Pennsylvania was part of the first major excavation of Ur, a city in southern Iraq, back in the 1920s. It has one of the largest collections of cuneiform tablets.
That is 5,000 years old. One of the oldest things human beings ever wrote.
That is the keeper of the collection, Philip Jones, with a small black tablet that probably recorded a real estate transaction.
One of the slight drawbacks of the last 30 years is that the Egyptologists have been able to dig, whereas we haven't. So they found lots of early stuff, which is about the same sort of period as our early stuff.
90 years ago, that first excavation of Ur was a joint effort by Penn, the British Museum, and the newly formed State of Iraq. Now Penn and the British Museum have begun an ambitious project to put all the artifacts online, so people doing research on related artifacts don't have to go to 3 different countries. The coordinator of that project is Brad Hafford. He says it will also help Iraq discover what it lost.
Our original concept back in 2003, when the Iraq Museum got looted, was that if Philadelphia and London knew what they had from Ur, then that should tell us what Iraq should have, and maybe that could help with them, their inventories, to find out what went missing.
The conference ends Thursday. The online archive is ongoing. I'm Peter Crimmins, WHYY News.
Some South New Jersey natives are trying to take their baseball bat company to the big leagues. WHYY's Joe Hernandez explains.
Gary Malik started making wooden baseball bats in 2011 on a lathe powered by a washing machine motor in his backyard.
And it was janky and old, and it finally decided that it wanted to break, and I'd fix it. Like,
back then, Malik could only make a few bats at a time, but now he's got a staff of 6 guys, a new machine to cut bats automatically, and even a laser engraver that cuts names into the barrels. Gary and his brother Mark both played baseball in college, but it was Mark who came up with the company's logo during an art class in Savannah, Georgia.
And it was boring, man, and I was sitting there drawing. I was drawing this, like, it was called the Carolina Haystackers, and I had this, like, crazy, ridiculous, like, old-school potato sack uniform guy. And then his teammate, I drew right next to him, and I just turned him into a bird for some reason, and, like, they kind of had a similar face, and then I just was like, the Birdman.
Birdman Bats has now sent its products to pros like Manny Ramirez and former Phillies outfielder Raul Ibanez. But Gary Malik says the bats have mostly gone to minor league players.
Really targeting. We want the young guys because, you know, it has that youthful spirit, and then they'll catch on, they'll love it, and they'll take it to the big leagues with them.
The Malik brothers, who live in California but are originally from Wildwood Crest, make all their bats out of birch, not maple or the popular ash, which has been endangered in recent years thanks to a beetle that eats away at ash trees.
Birch falls right in the middle. It has, like, the hardness almost, it's like just a hair under the hardness of maple, but it flexes like ash, so, like, it has, like, both properties.
And if the growth of Birdman is any indication, there seems to be a growing market for boutique bats, especially after news last year that the industry leader in big league barrels was being sold.
Wilson Sporting Goods is buying Louisville Slugger from Hillrick and Bradsby for $70 million.
They're doing terrible with their business because I think we're like a micro bat company. It's kind of like micro breweries, like running Budweiser and Coors out of the game. It's like, we're doing the same thing to Louisville. Like every one of
the group of former baseball players turned bat makers are now finding their sweet spot off the field. From the New Jersey desk, I'm Joe Hernandez, WHYY News.
Still ahead this evening, Jewish journalists, and in particular, Jewish conservatives who oppose Donald Trump have increasingly been the targets of online attacks with hateful speech and doctored images.
They're Holocaust victims, and then they superimpose my face on one of the victims.
NewsWorks Tonight continues on WHYY. An old argument has been rebooted for a new political age. Jews are destroying the country. Anti-Semitism has found currency among supporters of Donald Trump and has led to an increasing number of online attacks against two groups, Jewish anti-Trump conservatives and Jewish journalists. Matt Katz of member station WNYC reports.
I arrive at nap time at Bethany Mandel's second floor apartment in central New Jersey. Evidence of her two children under three, toys, and more toys, is everywhere.
Are the kids sleeping?
Yes.
Awesome.
She's a full-time mom who works from home, and that's why her laptop, open, is on the couch. But that's not what I came to see.
Can I see the gun?
Sure, I have to go get it.
She retrieves a purple box from the bedroom and lays it between us.
It's a .22 revolver. It's not loaded, obviously.
Mandel, 30 years old, is a politically conservative writer and an Orthodox Jew who has written in prominent Jewish and conservative publications about her opposition to Trump. That's why she had to buy a gun. She has faced thousands of anti-Semitic messages online, mostly from self-identified white nationalists who are big Trump supporters. Messages like,
"Die, you deserve to be in an oven, the world would be better off without you." And like,
it's the pictures, though, the memes they send her, that she has to hide from her children.
They're Holocaust victims, and then they superimpose my face on one of the victims.
Mandel has blocked thousands of users on Twitter who have gone after her. Twitter has been criticized for doing little to rid its site of such hate. But ultimately, Mandel blames Trump.
He's playing to the absolute bottom rung of our society. It feels like this is Germany in the 30s. Like, we're watching the rise of someone really, really dangerous.
So a couple of months ago, she packed up the kids and went to the gun shop. Then she wrote a piece for the Jewish Forward. "My Trump tweets earned me so many anti-Semitic haters that I bought a gun." It went viral.
I've had dreams about people lurking in my apartment since then, and the only way I can sort of talk myself down from that crazy ledge at 2 a.m. is, like, I can see my gun from my bed and, like, come at me. Everybody knows I have a gun now, like, and I'm really not afraid to shoot it.
The anti-Semites' initial targets were conservative writers who opposed Trump, but they soon went after mainstream reporters who cover him. They created an image of the decapitated yarmulke-wearing head of a Jewish editor at the New York Times. After Jewish journalist Julia Yaffe wrote a profile of Trump's wife for GQ, she had to file a police report about phone and email threats. Trump was specifically asked about the attacks on Yaffe by CNN's Wolf Blitzer.
What's your message to these people when something like that happens?
I haven't read the article, but I heard it was a very inaccurate article, and I heard it was a nasty article.
Trump said he had no message to his fans who send these tweets in his name. He has never specifically renounced them, and his spokeswoman declined to comment for the story. But it goes beyond just tweets. Anti-Semites created a program in Google's Chrome web browser to search for Jewish last names online. They then flag Jewish journalists by putting their names in triple parentheses in order for fellow white nationalists to identify Jews. In response, Yair Rosenberg of the Jewish publication Tablet magazine put the parentheses around his own profile name.
Right now, I don't think these people are much of a threat. That's why I mock them.
Rosenberg says these bigots are just anonymous internet-based trolls. But the Anti-Defamation League is concerned. Anti-Semitic incidents were up 3% nationally from 2014 to 2015, with a 50% increase in assaults. The group has set up a task force to specifically address concerns with Trump-backing neo-Nazis going after journalists. For me, it took just a few days of reporting on Trump before I was called a kike. Then my name was posted inside triple parentheses. I wanted to know why.
At the time, you know, when I did that, it was really nothing, you know, personal against you.
That's Tony, not his real name. He says he's 28, an Iraq war veteran, and a Trump supporter who flagged me on Twitter for being Jewish.
I mean, it is your ethnicity. I don't understand why you would be upset, regardless of, you know, who it is saying it. It's, you know, it's a factual matter.
Well, I think it comes to the fact that, you know, there's thousands of years of history in which Jews were minorities in whatever country they were in, similar to now, and then they were identified and scapegoated for whatever problems the country was having, and then totalitarian leaders took advantage of that scapegoating and used it as an excuse to exterminate or expel or murder the Jews within their populations.
I mean, looking at it logically, that's completely understandable.
But then he went on to say that white people are the ones who are scapegoated in modern America. A Twitter user who goes by a German pseudonym, Bluden Bloden, mocked a picture of my Jewish colleagues and I accepting a journalism award.
It's like four Jews and an Asian. It's just funny because you're four Jewish journalists. I could be wrong about one or two, but in New York, getting awards, being influential. You know, and it's just when we look around and we see what kind of influence do Jews have in academia, in the media, in Hollywood, in pornography, you know, all this different stuff. And we see it as subversive, as pernicious, as degenerate, as harmful, as corrosive.
There's a paradox here because Jews are an integral part of Trump's operation. His national finance chairman and his top attorneys are Jewish. One of his closest advisors is Jared Kushner, his son-in-law and the Orthodox Jewish husband to his daughter Ivanka, who converted. When speaking to Jews, Trump often mentions his Jewish grandchildren. And Kushner helps Trump write speeches to Jewish audiences. But Trump, like in a speech to Jews at a Republican Jewish coalition event, is known to go off script.
Is there anybody that doesn't renegotiate deals in this room negotiates perhaps more than any room I've ever spoken to.
Somehow Trump manages to stereotype Jews as cheap and get laughs. The kind of joke that usually only flies if it's a Jew saying it. Trump has drawn scrutiny for such insensitivity before. He retweets white supremacists, and he was slow to renounce an endorsement from former KKK leader David Duke. Yet many Jewish Republicans continue to back him. So I headed to Trump Tower to find out why. I took the elevator to the top floor to meet Jason Greenblatt, an Orthodox Jew, chief legal officer for the Trump Organization, and one of Trump's two advisors on Israel. Greenblatt says Trump respects him and supports Israel. He says Trump should not be blamed for anti-Semitic Twitter trolls whose presence is exaggerated by the media.
We don't even know how many there are. And I guess if somebody did a scientific study, I would suspect that there are plenty of Twitter trolls who support Hillary.
Greenblatt notes that Trump gave a statement to the New York Times after he came under scrutiny for the Duke endorsement. Trump had said that anti-Semitism has no place in society.
I recognize that some people think that he should do more. I don't think it's fair for me to constantly go to him and say, oh, this unknown Twitter troll said this, can you make a statement?
Recently, Greenblatt decided to put the triple parentheses Jewish signifier around his own Twitter handle to show that he stands in solidarity with those targeted. I'm Matt Katz.
That's all for tonight's show. NewsWorks Tonight is produced by Shai Ben-Yakov and Kimberly Haas, with additional production today from Brett Rader. Find us on iTunes or listen back at newsworks.org. Thanks for joining us. I'm Dave Heller for NewsWorks Tonight.